So, it is October 14th, I believe, 2009, and we are in Lawrence in class interviewing Eleanor Simons about the history of the Episcopal Church in Kansas and also some of her own story, I hope. Ms. Simons was a KU librarian for many years and was the religion specialist, and so we had a lot of contact over those many years, and she's now retired, but a long time, well, Anglican, and in America we say Episcopalian, and so I've asked her simply to come in and share some history, and we'll go from there and see where it goes.
Okay. Yes, so. I enjoyed work. I worked in various departments in Watson Library, but for a long time I worked with this department, building up their collections, and also I was the person to whom questions about religion were understood, were driven to, and I helped Professor Miller track down a lot of strange bibliographical things in the days when the internet was very new. We never did track them all down.
No, you did amazingly well, though.
I grew up in Cornwall, England, and came to Lawrence in 1957 to be a member of Watson Library staff. I belonged to the Church of England from my earliest days. I was baptized at the age of 6 weeks. And my family were very active in a small village church. So that when I came to Lawrence in 1957, I immediately was invited to Trinity Episcopal Church in Lawrence. And I've been active in many different ways at Trinity events. I think I've done everything but sing in the choir and teach children Sunday school. I've taught some adult classes, but they don't want me to singing.
Where do we go from here?
Where do you want me to begin?
Well, can you do something about how the Episcopal Church came to Kansas and how it got started here?
Yes. The Episcopal Church, Protestant Episcopal Church, to give it its full title, is an offshoot of the Church of England, which was in itself one of the products of the European Reformation, perhaps not so extremely reformed as some of the other churches at the time. And as soon as the English began coming to North America, the Church of England came with them, so that it was very strong in the eastern part of the country long before when they were still the colonies. The Church of England at that point in the United States was under the Bishop of London. He never came to look at it. If people here wanted to become priests in the church, they had to go to England, and that was quite a long and difficult journey in these days, and I understand that some of them died on the way. If people wanted to be confirmed, and we can say more later about confirmation if you want to know it, the bishop was the one to confirm them, and in those days, you could not receive communion in the Church of England unless you were confirmed. But they were allowed, if they were ready and prepared, to count themselves as confirmed and be allowed to take communion. After the independence, the revolution, the Protestant Episcopal Church was set up, still, of course, mostly in the East, and not very strong at that point because a lot of the English people had gone back to Britain. It's interesting that the constitution of the Protestant Episcopal Church is modeled on the constitution of the United States. That is, two houses, one with bishops and one with clergy and laypersons. People hadn't moved very far into this part of the country yet, but they were moving. And in 1835, the church decided that it must do something about this. So it called itself the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society and appointed two bishops to go out west. One of them was for Missouri and Illinois, and he was Jackson Kemper. The other one was for the Southwest, but that didn't go as well as Jackson Kemper did. He was determined to do something, and he did move out to this part of the world. Dr. Miller and I were saying just now that the saying is that the Baptist came on foot, the Methodist came on horseback, and the Episcopalians waited for the railroads. That is to some extent true, because in the history of the parish, history of the diocese, you will learn about missionaries. There was one priest who was a missionary on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad. So the church did spread as the railroad spread. First Episcopalians to set foot in Kansas were, not surprisingly, at Fort Leavenworth, where there was a chapel and a chaplain early on. There was also a priest called... got some notes here. One priest who, because of ill health, had come to... for some reason, to Kansas. Yes. He lived somewhere near Paola or Olathe, and Drummond was his name, John Drummond. And when he was well enough, he helped with the church there. But the real movement of the church began with... I was at a talk last evening about the development of Yankee cities in Kansas, especially Topeka. When the New England Emigrant Aid Society came, not that they were all from New England, and several people came with them, and churches were set up in the eastern part of the state around 1857, which was before Kansas was a state. And Bishop Kemper, therefore, was given... charge of this. Now, a diocese in the Episcopal Church is a geographical area which under a bishop, and all the clergy are ruled, that isn't the right one, guided, pastored by the bishop. After a certain amount of discussion, it was decided that the bishop should have his seat in Topeka, where there was already a church, Grace Church, which is now Grace Cathedral. There were several meetings of the clergy and of some lay people to ratify this. A couple of times it was said, there aren't enough of you really to elect a bishop. So we didn't elect a bishop until considerably later. That was 1864, by which time Kansas was a state, and there were more railroads. so that we were then able... Bishop Jackson Kemper did a great deal of moving around, and so did his clergy. You hear stories of them going out to... There were a couple of Episcopalians, 5 miles out in the country, on muddy roads, and they weren't feeling well enough to come into church, and the clergy and the bishop would go and visit them. Or if he heard that there were two Episcopal families in a place, he would go out and try to set up a church there, or at least get the nucleus of a church. In 1864, there were enough of us to elect our own bishop, and the first bishop of Kansas was Thomas Hubbard Vail. Now, although his cathedral, his see, his diocese was centered in Kansas, he lived here in Lawrence, and there was a there's a house down on I think it's the 400 block of Tennessee, which is the house in which he and his family lived, and he's in the parish registers of Trinity Episcopal Church. We now have our ninth bishop of Kansas. He too lives in Lawrence, Dean Wolfe. He's been here 5 or 6 years now. And we have churches. Well, I won't give you a list of all of them. They're far too many. At the time the church first started, Kansas wasn't yet a state. It didn't have a western boundary, and the Diocese of Kansas therefore extended as far west as you like to go into Colorado. I presume it stopped at the Rockies. When Kansas became a state, the state boundary became the boundary of the diocese. Since we were still spreading westward, in 1903, it was decided to make the western part of Kansas a separate, first a missionary district, and then a diocese. And again, the boundary was drawn not in a straight north-to-south line, but with a jog in it, so that Wichita was included in this part, the Diocese of Kansas, again because of railroad connections. And if you look at the maps of those days, you'll see that it was all based on how people could get to Topeka. The Western Kansas Diocese had its headquarters in Salina. It was hoped that some of these other cities, like Dodge City and Great Bend and that, would grow enormously, but they didn't grow as much as expected. So that although the Diocese of Kansas is just the eastern third of the state, it has all the sizable cities, Wichita, Topeka, Lawrence, and the Johnson County part of the Kansas City metropolitan area. So parishes in the western part of the state are pretty well scattered. I remember one priest who had been in liberal Kansas, and he said, well, his nearest neighbors were down in Oklahoma. He was a long way from any church in Kansas. What do I need to bring us up to date with? I've left us at about 1903. Yeah.
Well, I guess if we wanted to come way up to date, just jump over a century or nearly
so,
that.
Yes.
There have been some recent changes and conflicts.
Exactly.
Like starting,
yes.
I think, in the 1970s, the ordination of women.
Yes, in the 1970s, and it wasn't only the Episcopal Church, I think several churches experienced this. There were two conflicts going on at the same time. One was the ordination of women, which is still a sore point for some people. And the other one was changes in the prayer book, in the liturgy. And you know, the American prayer book was based on the Scottish prayer book rather than the English one. The English one had undergone some changes, but not many, since the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And we didn't want our prayer book changed. We liked the language of it the way it is. And this, in this diocese, Edward Turner was bishop. He was towards the end of his ministry, and he could cope with prayer book changes. I was on the committee that he appointed to look at introducing the new prayer book, but he was just too tired to think about the ordination of women, so he left that to his successor, who was Bishop Dick Grine. And Dick Grine, who was had been the rector in St. Michael and All Angels Mission, which is in the Johnson County area, had a young woman, so to speak, waiting in the wings to be ordained. So fairly soon after he became bishop, she became our first woman priest. Now there are a number of women priests in the diocese, and I think mostly they are accepted. But there were some, I think that's generally accepted. We haven't yet had a woman bishop, although some, I think about 8 dioceses throughout the country do have women bishops. And I don't think the women, yes, they may be now. At first they tended to be in the small churches or in assistant positions. But there were some parishes that, because of one or the other of those, broke away from the Episcopal Church. The most notable of those was Christ Church Overland Park, which again is in the Johnson County area, one of the biggest churches in the diocese. But they broke away. And now are on their own, but most of their members went to other churches in the Johnson County area. And they had huge ambitions. They were going to have a new camp, their new campus on Highway 10, several miles west of Kansas City. But that idea has gone, and I think they've sold the land back to other people. But there were churches, again, one in the Johnson County area, one in Topeka, that wanted to use the old prayer book and not change it at all and not have women. The other thing, and this is one of my pet subjects, so don't let me talk too long about it, is that the changes in the liturgy weren't just in the wording. How can you change the Lord's Prayer? It's always been that way. That's the way God, Jesus, gave it to us. It was the King James Version. But not just the language, but laypersons, men and first women, were allowed to do far more things in the church. Women, men and women, are allowed to read the lessons in church. They are allowed to help with serving the wine at communion. They're allowed to read the prayers and a number of other things. Oh, and to bring the wine and bread and wine forward from the back of the church and present it at the altar. And that I think is a good way in which the church is going. I don't know how far it'll go, but I think that more or less brings us up to date. Though there are also controversies about the ordination of gay persons. I think that sent some people out of the system. As long as they're going to church somewhere and not just stopping completely, which always happens when a parish or a diocese has a problem. Oh, another interesting thing, and that I think brings us up to the present day. For a while, there were separate churches for African Americans, or separate classes in the churches for them. There was one in Leavenworth. There was one in Kansas City, Kansas, Church of the Ascension. There was one in Topeka, St. Simon of Cyrene, and one, I think, in Wichita. But during the last, 40 or 50 years, those have all been absorbed into the other churches. There was a wonderful black deacon in Topeka who had set up St. Simon of Cyrene Church, then later became St. Philip's. When that church closed down, the bishop said to him, "You'll come to the cathedral until I find another church for you." And Joe served at the cathedral until he was 90-something years old. He tended to spend most of his life, and a lot of his sleeping hours as well, at the cathedral. And by towards the end, he was very tall, he tended to fall down. So people said, "Joe, why don't you sit? You don't have to stand." But he wouldn't do that until the bishop told him he mustn't sit. And Joe had several accidents, so they took away his car and took away his license. He died 4 or 5 years ago, driving without a license with somebody else's car to a church-related meeting. He had an accident and died. So I think that was the way Joe would want to go, was doing something for the church.
What are the numbers like? Mainline Protestants of all denominations have been on the decline for the last few decades. Is that true in the Episcopal Church, do you know, and in this diocese?
I don't, I'm sorry. I'd say that they've remained pretty steady. Partly because the church has student ministries, the nature of student ministry has changed recently, has student ministries that work hard to get people in. We've had some good campus ministers here in Kansas. And also because, to some extent, the Episcopal Church is a halfway place. When somebody, say, a Catholic and somebody from one of the extreme Protestant religions marry, the Episcopal Church is a place where they can meet to some extent and where they can bring up their children. But I'm sorry, I don't have any figures. Christchurch Overland Park, I know, was one of the biggest, and I think St. Michael's in Mission is quite a large one.
Have very many churches left recently over the gay ordination issue? I hear people complain about it, but I wonder, is it really just noise, or is it really affecting the church?
I don't know. There was a lot of fuss when a gay bishop was elected back east, but I haven't heard much noise about it recently. And I mean, I know there are admittedly gay persons taking lay positions in Trinity Parish, for instance, and nobody seems to worry about that. So I think it might have been just noise. It may have been part of what caused Christchurch to separate out, but I know this is going to be recorded, but the rector of Christchurch, I think, wanted to build his own empire, his own diocese, if you like. So he just needed an excuse for getting out. Oh, one priest back even earlier in the 70s or 80s joined the American Orthodox Church.
Oh, really?
But he didn't take his congregation with him.
That's been a real growth area for Orthodoxy. They've gathered people from a surprisingly wide variety of American denominations.
Well, they haven't changed at all, have they?
And they're pretty steady. I wonder, you've mentioned a couple of colorful persons.
Yes.
Do you have any other persons that you think are especially noteworthy?
Going back into the 19th century again, one of my favorites is the Reverend Archibald Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y. He was the one who was the missionary on the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad and did a lot of traveling by trains, helping to found churches in Emporia and Wichita and other places between. When then he came back to be rector of Trinity Lawrence, but he still had missionary zeal about him. When Haskell Institution was founded in the 1880s, he went out to Haskell and baptized 20 or 25 Haskell students. We know nothing about them except their names on a page in our parish register. And I wonder if you've ever seen the cemetery from the early days at Haskell, whether any of those that he baptized were buried there or whether he kept in touch with any of them. There is a recently published history of Haskell, and I must look that up sometime. But he continued, he retired from being the rector, but continued to go to diocesan meetings until he was, I think, well in his 90s and had quite a lot to say in guiding the diocese. I don't. He's the one who stands out in my mind, and Joe Thompson among the deacons.
Could you say something about people in the local church where you've been involved? I've seen quite a few priests go by, I would say.
Yes. I started getting involved, and that's not just going to church, as soon as I came here, because my family had been very involved in the church back in England. At that time, our rector was John McLaughlin, who always said that his problem was that he was half Swedish and half Irish, and those two didn't really mix very well. He went on to be an assistant to the bishop at the diocesan that was much happier. Harvard Wilbur was one of my favorites. He got me interested in liturgy and in other things. Bob Matthews, John McCauley, who also taught here. Holly Hutchins was an interim. Where are we? Holly. Tom Lomberg, Jonathan Jensen, who's just left to become the dean of the cathedral in Little Rock, Arkansas. He's going to be a bishop one day. You could see it in him from the beginning. I think everybody would agree with that. And now we have an interim pastor, Ron Pogue, who's from Galveston Island and isn't used to the cold yet in Lawrence, but he's moving us very nicely onward. And Paul McLean, who is a curate, who's been with us about a year and a half, and he's a very good leader and a very good working with people person. Oh, and I must mention John Rosebaugh. John Rosebaugh was a priest back east in, I think, Pennsylvania. He came here probably in the 1940s or 50s because his wife was ill, and I think she had Alzheimer's, but it wasn't yet defined, and his daughter was here. And John Rosebaugh, who was about that high, helped out in at Trinity whenever required, and helped out at St. David's Topeka, going across, over there to do an early service on Sunday mornings. Then his daughter, Constance, who had her own ideas of the church, would join him for a later service over there. But he was, I think feisty is the word. He's very determined, very outspoken, but a sheer delight. And when the doctors told him he couldn't live on his own anymore, what did he do? He just quietly died. But he had a long life and a very great influence on this, on Trinity Parish. St. Margaret's Parish, which is out west of here on 6th Street, was founded about 10 or more years ago when the bishop and the diocesan council of that time were very interested in founding new churches. And Lawrence was expanding westward, so you go and build a church out there. The first land chosen for it was about where Corpus Christi Catholic Church is. At that point, it was a meadow full of cows. But we dedicated that site. That was when John McCauley was our rector, and Bishop Smalley had just come. We sat around on hay bales, and it was hard to get at that point. You had to come get at it from the other side, the west side, down a steep hill and up again. We buried some communion wafers, and we erected a wooden cross. And next day, of course, the cows knocked down the cross. But that was the beginning of St. Margaret's. After a bit, they were given land up north of 6th Street, where the building is now. And there was a campaign, a saturation campaign, where a whole team of people telephoned, I think, everybody in Lawrence and the surroundings and said, look, we're not trying to drag you away from your church, but we are founding a new church. If you want a new church, if you want, please come and see us. And that got a tremendous result. St. Margaret's has had some financial problems, but it's managed to build a new parish hall recently. It has a new rector, Matt Zimmerman, who was installed a couple of weeks ago. And Trinity helped to start that. They had their offices in Trinity for a while. Then they had their services in a school. But they're growing, and I think they will grow in the future.
Well, they say a lot of church growth has to do with geography, and they're certainly poised in that regard.
Yes, they are. There is, that was under Bishop Brine, I think. There was a move for creating new churches or moving churches. They founded a number of new churches in the, or move churches, in the Johnson County area. St. Thomas, which was a fairly new church. Well, most of the churches in the Johnson County area are from the 1950s, because that's when Johnson County grew. St. Thomas was moved further south to get ahead of the way the city was, cities were developing. And there is now a campaign going on. There is a priest whose job is to found new churches, three new churches in that southern Johnson County area, because Kansas City is moving that way. There's a whole area there that could well be, but I haven't heard of many results yet. And I know the priest, he's an English priest, who is part-time at Stillwell, which is fairly far south in Johnson County, and he is skeptical about the move. But then he tends to be skeptical. That just may be him. And I don't know what will happen. The tendency has been in the last 40 or 50 years to plant more churches in urban areas and close down the ones that are in the country, partly because people now mostly have transportation and get into the urban areas, partly because a small area can't necessarily afford to pay to support a full-time priest, and the diocese has to move in and support it. So Topeka now has three churches: the cathedral, St. David's, which was founded in the 1950s when the town was growing westward. It's now gone a lot further west than St. David's. And St. Philip's, which is on the eastern side of Topeka. St. David's had a fire last year, probably arson, because it had an open area, and maybe somebody slept there overnight and dropped a match or something like that, but it seems to have rebuilt well. In Wichita, there are six or seven churches now. Some of the smaller ones have merged, and again, they're moving westward. But so many of the small town churches have closed down. There's one still in Ottawa. There's one still in Olathe, which was, of course, the county seat of Johnson County in early on. But that's had its ups and downs. I think it's pretty well up at the moment. For a brief while, there was a church at Tonganoxie, started by a layperson, which meant that if you wanted a communion service, clergy had to come in to do it. Where else? There were churches. Look at a map of this map of 1972. There's still a church in Wamego, which is between Topeka and Manhattan, even though Manhattan is there. There was a church in Edwardsville, Tonganoxie. Places like most of these are still there, even if they're small. But that has been a tendency, and I think will continue to be a tendency. The church on campus, I should say something about. I think early on, there was a close relationship between Trinity Church and the university, because the first chancellor of the university was the rector of Trinity Church, and he hoped to start a Episcopal university up there, but there wasn't the money, but he was still very much involved in it. And the idea of full-time campus chaplains didn't start until about the 1950s, with Canterbury House on campus here, and a full-time or sometimes part-time chaplain. One at Manhattan, Kansas, which also had a full-time part-time chaplain. And I've been at meetings where there have been discussions as to whether they should keep the chaplain or not, because a campus ministry is not self-supporting. When the present bishop came, he changed the system. There are now, he wants more campus ministry in the areas, in the colleges, not just in the big ones. So there is still a Canterbury House here in Lawrence with two priests, one woman, one man, but the Pittsburgh and Emporia and the other universities have their own in-house ministry with the other people coming to visit them. And that, there's another colourful figure who is Joe Alford, who was the Episcopal chaplain here for a number of years. And when they changed the system, Joe went back for a couple of years to two parishes in Tennessee, and Tennessee is very much his home, and it's very dear to him. But he's now at a retreat center, Chantavanam, which is north of here, being the cook, and he seems to enjoy it too. It was he who started the Jubilee Cafe, which still provides breakfasts twice a week. It's now housed at the First Methodist Church downtown, and it is a cafe. People sit at tables and are served. It started with the Canterbury House students and other people from other churches. And it gives the people there, they're part of it. They have a sort of dignity, and they have conversations with the servers, and I don't know who's being ministered to, whether it's both the servers and the customers there. Thinking of Trinity Church again, yes. We had in the 1970s, 80s and 90s, a Nigerian family, the Adeyanjus. They've come to the United States earlier and taught in Ohio. They came to Trinity, well, the first time they were in Lawrence, Matthew, who taught at the University of Kansas, came to church to see what Trinity was like. And that afternoon, the rector visited the Adeyanju family. There were five children, very young then, but eventually Matthew was our senior warden, which is the top layperson in the parish. His wife worked for the altar guild, who prepare things for the communion service, and all five of his children served as acolytes, helping the clergy and the chalice bearers during communion. And this was, they were the most wonderful family. This was at a time of when the parish wasn't very happy. Matthew was our church warden, and he kept us together purely by being Matthew, and by having a devout faith, family support, an idea of organization, and a great sense of loyalty. So he has to be reckoned as one of the. They then moved off to Athens, Ohio, but the daughter was married. The eldest daughter was married at Trinity Church 3 or 4 years ago. And that was one of the most wonderful weddings I've ever been to, because when a West African eldest daughter is married, everybody of the family comes from all over the world. And there were these Nigerian ladies in wonderful brocades. And that was a beautiful service. So they were beautiful people. What else do we need to know?
What kind of social life has there been apart from regular worship? Potluck dinners?
Potluck dinners. We have a, at the church, we now have a evening 6:30 service, which is very ceremonial, very high church. That's meant mainly for the students, and they have a potluck dinner, a dinner that's served by some family each week. So next Sunday is the Sunday when we all make our pledges of what we're going to contribute next year, and there are going to be two dinners there for which we sign up. During Lent, sometimes we've had potluck dinners and a special evening, midweek evening service during Lent. There's a group that meets in one another's homes once a month for a potluck dinner, and that's been going on with breaks for a long time. Coffee is a very important part of being an Episcopalian. You can't be an Episcopalian without having coffee. In England, it's tea, of course. And after every Sunday service, there's coffee and refreshments, especially on the first Sunday in the month, to honor those people who are having birthdays during the month. So yes, and the vestry, the governing body, which meets monthly or more often, always has drinks and refreshments. So yes, there's a fair bit of social life for those who want it, but other people just want to come on Sundays and not take part in anything else. My mother spent more time when I was a teenager making cups of tea, including one famous occasion when there were 100 people in the congregation and we had only 50 cups. And that meant that as soon as somebody had drunk his or her tea, you snatched the cup away and somebody washed it. But I said that I'm never going to do anything like that for the church. That's not mine, but I realize it's not my ministry, but it was her ministry. And she was, yeah, because she, all, this is the Church of England, they also had, during World War II, special meetings for, there were mothers and children evacuated from London and the big towns down to our part of the country, and she helped with meetings for those. Yes, so there's a good social life. And at the moment, since, as I said, Trinity is looking for a new rector or deciding what we want in a new rector, there are a series of meetings, some at the church, some at people's homes, where people will get together and discuss, and I know there will be at least coffee and cookies at those, because you can't have an Episcopal meeting without them. There's one at Brandon Woods, where I live, and I've got to see about coffee and cookies for that. But there are opportunities to get together. There used to be, when women couldn't do much else except in the kitchen, there used to be women's groups who met weekly or monthly for discussions and needlework and things like that. What else?
Just one other piece of history. You know, 100 years ago, there was this mass movement, largely in Protestant churches, for prohibition, alcohol prohibition. I have never had the impression that Episcopalians were much on board with that. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about it. I know we have alcohol at... Yes, there's usually alcohol at vestry meetings.
Is there?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I've never heard anything about it, so I don't think it could be important. Oh, I mentioned Haskell, Indian Nations University. Then, when it started, it was Haskell Institute, and there's always been a sort of good relationship between the Episcopal Church and Haskell. When I was first here, we took, and then it was a sort of technical high school. We took coffee and cookies or some sort of program out to them once a month, and I think they came mostly for the food. Haskell students were very quiet and didn't respond very much to the programs. But there have been, well, at one point we weren't allowed to be on the Haskell campus, but the Lutherans had a house just outside and we shared with that. At present, we are the wife of our curate, Paul McLean, is one quarter Cherokee, and she's taking classes out at Haskell, and she's arranging for transportation for Haskell students when they arrive in Lawrence by bus or train. And I think the transporters take them out for a meal and supply them with some necessities and take them to Haskell, so the relationship goes on.
Well, I think that covers the basics. Any of the rest of you like to ask anything, Rachel?
I'm curious, what was it like transitioning from the Church of England to the Episcopal Church here in Kansas? What was that like for you?
Very little change. As I said, the prayer book then, I came before the prayer book had been changed. There was very little difference. And it depended in England what sort of church you went to. I went to a church that had mostly morning prayer and evening prayer, and when I came here, there were more Eucharistic celebrations, and that's grown up over the years. The Lord's Prayer was slightly different. Yes, it can be different. As we forgive them that trespass against us, those who trespass against us. And I still say, forever and ever, not forever and ever. Except in the new translation, you don't have to do that. There are little differences like that. And back in England, in fact, my father, who was church warden, senior warden, read the lessons at church for a long time, long before laypersons, non-clerics, were doing it here. I grew up in a small country church. We had morning prayer and evening prayer, and I think there were about as many more people probably at evening prayer than at morning prayer. Whereas here, I don't think anybody much has evening prayer anymore. Oh, we also had Sunday school on Sunday afternoons. And the mission church in which that was held was, a mile or so uphill from where I lived. And you had to do this right after Sunday lunch. But now, here at Trinity, Sunday school goes on during or between services. And we didn't have any adults in the school. Oh, yes, we did. My aunt taught an adult Sunday school class. I think she mostly read worthwhile stories to them, because they were elderly ladies who couldn't read, and this was the pleasure, what they liked.
Couldn't read for lack of schooling?
Yeah. Because these would have been, I'm talking about the 1930s now, and these were people, there was Education Act was 1870, they should have, so they might have even skipped that.
It's kind of hard for us to imagine, people could grow up in relatively modern times.
Yep. Well, they didn't have occasion to use their reading, so they probably didn't work very hard at it. They would read newspapers, and there was something called the Sunday Companion, which they all read. And the parish magazine.
any other questions anyone else would like to ask? Well, I think we should probably wrap it up then. So thank you for coming.
And is anybody coming down to a service at Trinity? Is that part of the plan?
Well, not particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think church visits work out to be part of this program in a number of cases.
Well, you have done them before now.
Uh-huh.
Had somebody, no, I don't think it was one of you, had somebody call me a week or so ago asking about the architecture of Trinity Church. Hmm. I referred him to somebody else.
That is something to mention, actually. There have been changes. Wasn't there an old church?
There was an old 1857 church just to the south of where the present one is. This one was built in 1870 when Lawrence was growing and there was more prosperity, although we couldn't pay off the debt on it until about 1874, and it couldn't be consecrated until the debt was paid off. And there's a wonderful description in the local paper of the service on Easter Day 1974, and that place must have been, wedding decorations aren't in it, that church must have been absolutely full of floral decorations. Then the church burned down in the mid-1950s, everything but the walls. So when I came here in 57, they'd just completed building it up again. Knew everything inside, except that the cross on the altar was saved from the fire. New stained glass windows, which were put in over a period of several years, and they show scenes from the life of Christ. And we had a dedication service where we read the stories of each of these scenes and sang a hymn about them. Yes, then we pulled down that 1857 building because, like everything on that side of the hill, it had no upright anywhere in it. You know, floors sink, foundations sink there. And then built a parish hall, which again was remodeled in the 1970s. Then we bought, no, yes, we bought, we pulled down an old house next to the church and built, took over what had been a lawyer's building, and that's now used for parish offices, and we have a chapel there. In the latest remodeling, which was 2 or 3 years ago, there were, in the 1970 remodeling, there were cloisters. But now we glassed in the cloisters, took out the wall that was inside, which made the parish hall look considerably larger. We all didn't like this idea, but it's worked out very well. And we have more Sunday school rooms and more meeting rooms downstairs, and they are used by various organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous and other groups. So I don't know if we're going to do any more remodeling. There were several plans, some of which took away that grassy spot out in front, and you don't want them to do that.
Well, I appreciate your coming, and I just want to be clear here that we are planning to make a public record.
Yes, I know. I was careful what I said.
Now, before I turn the recorder off, what would you have said if we weren't recording?
I don't know. Well, every bishop is different. Every priest is different. And you'll have your people who talk about good old Father so-and-so's days. Mm-hmm. And when I was first here, there was one older couple. The husband had not been to church since the 1920s because of what the parish did to Father so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not naming any names, but you know, you're bound to get that. You're bound to get your favorites.
Absolutely inevitable.
Yeah. Thank
you. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate
it.